Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Turkey's president says no to providing arms for Kurdish fighters in Syria. And President Obama urges Americans not to give in to Ebola hysteria. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. Turkey says it will not arm or agree to arm transfers to Kurdish fighters battling Islamic State militants for Kobani, the Syrian town just across the Turkish border. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan today called the embattled Kurdish forces equal to the Kurdistan Workers' Party, currently engaged in a 30-year armed campaign for self-rule in Turkey. Both Turkey and the U.S. consider the Kurdistan Workers' Party a terrorist group. The Turkish president said it would be very wrong to expect the Turkish government to openly say yes to our NATO ally America giving this kind of support, and further called it impossible. He made the comment days after the U.S. said it held its first direct talks with Syria's Kurdish Democratic Union Party, which is tied to the Kurdish fighters in Kobani. Meanwhile, U.S. officials report coalition jets made 8 airstrikes on Islamic targets in Syria overnight, 6 in Kobani. And Hong Kong police fought with protesters early today, deepening a sense of the impasse between the government and pro-democracy movement. Dozens of police with shields and helmets pushed into a crowd of mostly student demonstrators gathered at barricades in the Mong Kok district. The Associated Press said 20 people were injured in the crush. The fighting came just hours after Hong Kong's government said it will most likely begin talks with student demonstrators on Tuesday. President Barack Obama is calling on Americans not to give in to Ebola hysteria or fear.
Ebola is actually a difficult disease to catch. It's not transmitted through the air like the flu.
The international aid agency Oxfam is appealing to European Union foreign ministers to do more in the fight against Ebola, a disease Oxfam said could be the definitive humanitarian disaster of our generation. This is VOA News. 4 civilians are dead in new fighting between Ukrainian forces and pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine. Last month's ceasefire has mostly held in the region, except in the separatist stronghold of Donetsk, where Kiev's forces and the insurgents are engaged in daily battles for control of the city's airport, with neither side able to claim a win. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has held what the State Department calls an unprecedented and substantive dialogue with a senior Chinese official at Kerry's private home in Boston. Kerry hosted China's State Councilor Yang Jiechi for 2 days of very informal but candid talks on a wide range of issues, including Ebola, along with the Islamic State and Iranian and North Korean nuclear programs.
So there are many issues that China and the United States are cooperating on, even as we have some differences that we try to manage effectively. And right now, particularly on Ebola, on Afghanistan, on the Democratic Republic of North Korea, the North Korean nuclear situation, on Iran particularly, and on ISIL and counterterrorism, and on climate change. There are many areas where we are working hard.
They also discuss such sensitive matters as human rights, pro-democracy marches in Hong Kong, and U.S. charges of Chinese counter-spying. India's ruling Bharatiya Janata Party has won elections in 2 key states, trouncing the Congress Party and consolidating its position as the country's dominant political party. Huge margin in northern Haranya, where it won an outright majority, and in western Maharashtra state, where it emerged as the largest party, were set off by celebrations of party workers. Independent political analyst Neeraj Chaudhary says the 2 elections clearly demonstrate the BJP is now on a political roll.
The BJP is moving ahead, you know, by leaps and bounds. I mean, if you look at Haryana, it's a 12-fold increase in seats.
The BJP head, Amit Shah, called the victories an endorsement of Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government. And just as it seemed the Roman Catholic Church might ease its stance on homosexuality, bishops from around the world removed language doing that from a new Vatican document.
Those things, we could see that there are different viewpoints on this particular matter. And some who feel that let's do more research, let's take decisions. Now, on this we'll have to study, it will take time. It's important. It's important that we are honest with ourselves, honest with the church, and trying to our best to help people.
At the close of the 2-week assembly, the bishops also failed to approve paragraphs on allowing divorced and remarried Catholics to receive communion. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
After analyzing all the procedures during the recently held elections, we concluded that the elections were married with the irregularities.
RENAMO, a major Mozambican opposition party, vows to challenge the recent general election. We'll have their reasons.
We are calling for a constitutional amendment. However, in this country, amending the constitution, or indeed coming up with a new constitution, is superintended by those in power.
A Zambian Catholic priest calls for a constitutional amendment. We'll find out why.
Damara and an activist identified as Chawana Dano were arrested today after petitioning President Mugabe.
And a Zimbabwean news editor is arrested for calling on President Robert Mugabe to step down. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Attorneys for Mozambique's main opposition RENAMO party are gathering evidence to launch a legal challenge of the credibility of the recently concluded presidential and parliamentary elections, citing overwhelming instances of voter irregularities, says Eduardo Namburetti, the opposition party's external affairs head. The Electoral Commission has been announcing provisional results of the general election. But Namburetti told me earlier that RENAMO will challenge the results of the poll after the electoral body announces the final outcome of the elections.
After analyzing all the procedures during the recently held elections, we concluded that the elections were married with the irregularities, from ballot stuffing, from denial of polling agents to play their role at the polling stations, from denial of voters in the areas where we enjoy strong support from casting their votes. At this moment, we are gathering those evidence to present to the authorities.
Dr. Namburetta, the international observers, as well as local poll observers, have said that the elections were largely free, fair, transparent, and credible. So what is RENAMO saying about this?
Well, the local observers, most of them, and particularly Parlamento Juvenil, Human Rights League, the Forum of Community Radios, which had more than 2,000 observers on the ground, they came public to say that there were a lot of irregularities and that the elections were not free and fair. On the other hand, we had the international observers that they just landed a couple of weeks ago, and some of them are leaving the country now. And they only observed in part of the polling station, the voting process, the casting of the vote. And they came public to say the elections were free and fair. Maybe we have a different understanding of what it means to have a free and fair election. Because casting the vote, it's not by itself election. And for us, we have a different understanding of what it means to have a free and fair election. We have to analyze everything that entails electoral process, not only the casting of the vote. We have to see the initial process. For example, how our polling agents were denied access to the polling station in the very first moment of the voting. In most polling stations, the voting process started without the polling agents because they were not given the credential, the accreditation papers, to sit on the polling station. And during the counting, there was a lot of issues also that happened. Power cuts deliberately to make sure, you know, to create an environment where the ballot could be stuffed, arrest of polling agents. So those are the things that the international observers, they deliberately don't want to see and they don't want to consider in their reports, which is very unfortunate.
What do you say to critics who say that RENAMO is known for always saying that the elections were marred when they know very well that they are losing? And that is a mark of a sour losing party that always raises questions when things do not go their way. What do you say to that?
Well, I would say maybe those people, they just don't want to see the reality in our country, what is happening. This time, we had a third contestant for this election, who is the president of the Movement for Democracy, Mr. David Simango. He also came and said the elections were not free and fair. This time, we have a civil society organization, very credible organizations like the Parlamento Juvenil, the Human Rights League, and others, Forum Mulher, and even the Human Rights Commission, that came and said there were irregularities, serious ones. So it's not only RENAMO saying this. In the past, because people did not really understand what was happening on the ground, they would say so. But this time, I believe only those who are associated with Frelimo would say that RENAMO is not right in its content. We have a situation where only 500 people showed up to vote. But at the end of the counting, you would see a voting slip, a tally of votes showing that the candidate of the ruling party got 968 votes. How that is possible? And this is not something that happened in only one voting station. It happened in many voting stations. So it's not only about saying that there was a fraud. There are evidence clearly shows that there was ballot stuffing.
Eduardo Namburetti is RENAMO's external affairs head. He spoke with me earlier from the Mozambican capital, Maputo. Five suspected Al-Shabaab militants have been killed and a car laden with explosives and six suicide vests recovered. The militant had engaged troops from the Kenyan Defense Force in a shootout before they were killed on the Ethiopian side near the border town of Moyale. Silas Ambachi is the head of the Crime and Investigation Desk at a major Kenyan daily newspaper, the East African Standard. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached him in Nairobi by phone for details.
Well, according to the military personnel, they were telling us that they had intelligence that there was a vehicle which was coming from Somalia crossing to Kenya, and it had some explosives on board. So they tried to trace it to Mandera. Mandera is on the border of Kenya and Somalia. But the vehicle called the occupants realized that they were being trailed, so they changed their route. They went to use the route from the other side of Moyale, Ethiopia. You see, the Kenyan map, which is a border of Somalia and Ethiopia. So they just crossed into Kenya, and that's when there was a clash between them and the military from the military officers who are manning the area. So as a result, according to the military, five of them were killed, and they recovered almost 100 kilograms of TNT used to make bombs. And these explosives, they are saying, which had been assembled. We don't know to say where they are going to be used, but they are saying the explosives were headed towards Nairobi.
And did the military identify those militants?
They said it's clear that they are members of Al-Shabaab terror group. That's according to the Department of Defense spokesman, Mr. Bogito Ngeri, it's clear that the attacker, or the chief, they say the suspected assailants were members of Al-Shabaab and targeting and took place for an attack.
And this area, as you say, is at the border between Kenya and Somalia. Is there tension in that area?
It's true, there's tension in the border area. You see, Mandera itself, even within Mandera itself, Mandera town, there's already tension between them and the clans which live there. It's a free area which even if you are on the other side of Somalia, you go to Kenya, no one will know whether you are Kenyan or Somalia. The fact that they moved this is out of intelligence. They are informed that there's a vehicle coming from Somalia headed for Nairobi, Kenya. That's how the money is actually intercepted. Otherwise, there have been no such intelligence. I believe that those guys could have managed to slip through to Kenya, to Nairobi or any other place they wanted to be.
Is there a sense that maybe now that Al-Shabaab is being hit so hard inside Somalia, that maybe now they could be bring the insurgents into Kenya?
That's what my management told is believe that Al-Shabaab now themselves they are facing a lot of heat. Because you see, after the fall of Barawe, which was their main stronghold, now they went to Jilib. That's where they're holding. Jilib is not far away from Kenyan border. And even Jilib itself is under siege now because the AMSOM and the KDF, they're preparing for a major offensive there. So we're told that some of them are living slowly. And we believe some of these, those who are living are the ones now sleeping to Kenya to try to attack Kenya where they can distract the attention of those KDF which are in Somalia.
That was Silas Ombachi, the head of the crime investigation desk at a major Kenyan daily newspaper, the East African Standard. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from Nairobi. A Roman Catholic priest has called for a major constitutional amendment that would compel all future presidential candidates to undergo rigorous medical checkups. The results will be made public in a bid to determine their mental and physical health fitness ahead of any future general election. Father Frank Bwalya, who heads the opposition party, the Alliance for Better Zambia, told me earlier that there is no constitutional provision that requires politicians who aspire to the high office of the presidency and commander-in-chief of the armed forces to undergo medical tests to determine their health fitness to do the job.
In this country, we treat our leaders as if they were gods, and we give them special conditions, the kind of conditions we don't give ordinary people, and I'm totally against this. Our party, Alliance for Better Zambia, is totally against this. One of them is the issue of the fitness, the health of a person who wants to become Republican president. In the Constitution, there is nothing about what kind of criteria such a person should meet in order to qualify to stand as Republican president. And yet, everyone, almost everyone else, wants to get a job in this country, goes for a medical test. If you want to become a police officer, you want to become an army officer, you have to go for a medical test. And you actually go for a physical examination. They make you run. They make you undertake rigorous physical exercises in order to establish your physical health. However, for a Republican president, a candidate, nothing like that. There's nothing like that in the Constitution. And yet, to be a police officer, an army officer, is less taxing compared to the job of a Republican president. So I've been trying to say to the Zambian people, let's wake up and see that there's something wrong here. And history has taught us that, in fact, it would have saved our country better. Already, we've had a situation where a sitting president died from illness. A president who shouldn't have stood in 2006. He shouldn't have stood, but he went ahead and stood and died in office.
Are you therefore calling for a constitutional amendment to have this provision of a medical checkup on all presidential aspirants vying for the position of the president of Zambia?
Yes, we are calling for a constitutional amendment. However, in this country, amending the constitution, or indeed coming up with a new constitution, is superintended by those in power. And they have always blocked that. Because when you are trying to review the constitution in this country, you follow the Inquiries Act, which provides for a sitting government to accept certain provisions the Zambian people may propose or to reject. And they would usually reject such kind of a proposal because they are selfish. And so before I even call for a constitutional amendment, I'm trying to raise awareness among the people that we need this. It's costly to the country. It's discriminatory. Why are we subjecting other people to these examinations? And we don't want to subject it to the president. Is this special? No, is just an ordinary person who is employed by the people.
So basically you are saying that since the head of state is basically the commander-in-chief of the army, you should also have the same test that ordinary soldiers and security officials go through before they are hired?
Because it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense that the commander-in-chief himself has not undergone a medical test, has not been established to be physically fit, and yet those that he's commanding are made to go through such kind of a process. It's discriminatory. And why should we treat him like a god when he's not? He's just an ordinary human being like us. And because they are human, they are mortal. That's why they die in office, just like we die while on duty.
Some supporters of the Patriotic Front are saying that you are playing politics with the health of the president, especially when there are allegations of him being in poor health condition, and that is why you are raising this point at this time. And they said that it should be frowned upon and quite unfortunate for a Catholic priest to be raising this issue or playing politics with the health of a sitting president. What do you say to that?
As I speak to you, I've not mentioned our current president, I've not mentioned his name. I'm talking about an issue. His term will end. If he goes for a second term, that will come to an end. Zambia will still be there. Our children will still be there until Jesus comes. So I'm not talking about an individual. I'm not talking about an individual political party. I'm talking about the country. I'm talking about the future of our people, our children, even those that are not yet born. We should not suspend doing something good because we have been misunderstood to be targeting somebody. No, this is something beyond the man who is there. Besides, if we put in the Constitution this provision, it will not affect him because he's already president. It won't affect him. So how can they accuse us of talking about him? It's not him. We are talking about those who are not yet, that they would need to go through a medical examination to ascertain their suitability for that highly taxing and stressful office.
Father Frank Bwalya is head of Zambia's opposition party, the Alliance for Better Zambia. He spoke with me earlier from the capital, Lusaka. Ethnic Zahrawi is from the Western Sahara conflict who are living in refugee camps in the Algerian desert, seem to be genuinely able to leave the camps if they so wish. This despite reports of cases of abuse, according to Human Rights Watch. As Sela Hennessy reports for VOA from London, Human Rights Watch says the United Nations must do more to monitor human rights at the camp.
Human Rights Watch researchers say during their two-week visit to the camps, they did find evidence of some abuse, but that there's been an exaggeration by some parties. Eric Goldstein spoke to VOA from Algiers.
In fact, they're able to leave if they so wish to travel mainly to Mauritania and back to the Western Sahara if they want. And so it's not true that these falsehoods simply prevents them from leaving.
Researchers who visited the refugee camps say they were able to move about freely and interview refugees of their choice in private. In 1975, Morocco annexed the Western Sahara, sparking a war between Moroccan forces and the independence movement, the Polisario Front. The Algerian-backed Polisario Front says Morocco has consistently violated the human rights of Sahrawis. But Morocco, in turn, accuses Polisario forces of committing abuses at the Sahrawi refugee camps in the Algerian desert, which the Polisario Front has run for the past 40 years. HRW says the rights group does have some concerns about abuse at the camps.
We did hear of some cases where people were harassed for having expressed dissent.
Goldstein says 4 years ago, the Polisario detained one camp resident for more than 2 months after he spoke in support of Moroccan rule. The Polisario then sent him across the border to Mauritania and barred him from returning to the refugee camps where his family lives. But the campaign group says it has no evidence that the Polisario has imprisoned anyone else for their political beliefs during the past 3 years. Nonetheless, Goldstein says human rights in the camps need to be regularly observed. The United Nations operates a peacekeeping mission in Western Sahara, but unlike most similar missions, it has no mandate to conduct regular human rights monitoring, either in the Western Sahara or in the camps. Serene Rashed from the rights group Amnesty International says it's key for the UN mandate to be extended, and not only for the welfare of the Sahrawis,
but also to de-escalate tension around the conflict, given that frequent allegations of human rights violations by both sides are part of the tension that's happening in the region.
The Polisario says it would welcome enlarging the mandate of the UN peacekeeping force in the region, the mission for the referendum in Western Sahara, or MINURSO. But Morocco has opposed it, saying it would be an infringement of the sovereignty it claims over the Western Sahara. Without that mandate, Rashed says, it's impossible to know what's really happening on the ground.
So in the context where allegations are being frequently exchanged, an independent voice that is able to assert the facts of the human rights situation on the ground and which has a sustained presence, unlike us, Amnesty International or Human Rights Watch, who are only able to go from time to time for limited periods, would really be beneficial in the long term.
According to the UN, there's up to 125,000 refugees living in the camps. The refugees endure harsh desert conditions, depend heavily on international humanitarian aid, and have limited job opportunities. The UN classifies Western Sahara as a non-self-governing territory and does not recognize Morocco's annexation. Saleh Hennessy for VOA News, London.
And a Zimbabwean editor, Itaya Zamara of the News Leader newspaper, was arrested after calling on President Robert Mugabe to step down in a petition that was delivered to the office of the head of state. Thomas Chiripasi has details for VOA from the capital, Harare.
Zamara and an activist identified as Tshawana Dano were arrested today after petitioning President Mugabe over the poor performance of the country's economy. After delivering the petition, Zamara and Dano went to Harare Central Police Station to notify the police that they were organizing protests that were set to begin next week in Harare. Zamara is also advertising the planned protest through his Facebook page and a WhatsApp group called Occupy Africa Unity Square. At the time of going to air, lawyers from the Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights were still at Harare Central Police Station trying to locate Zamara and Dano. Police spokesperson Cherit Charamba told Studio 7 by phone that she was investigating the matter before publishing a statement. A copy of the petition delivered to Mr. Mugabe's office that is in Studio 7's possession encourages the president to step down immediately and pave way for a process of engagement involving all national stakeholders towards the establishment of a new administration that takes over to manage the country and prepare for fresh elections. The petition also advised Mr. Mugabe that the protests dubbed Occupy Africa Unity Square would start on Monday until the president left office and met other demands such as responding to the petition. Before his arrest, Zamara had also written on his Facebook page that he would be quitting journalism to focus on the anti-Mugabe demonstrations. The petition also urged Mr. Mugabe not to unleash state security agents on people who would be demonstrating. The planned demonstrations are similar to those that were held in Egypt and Tunisia that resulted in the leaders of those countries leaving office. Reporting for Studio 7 from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi. We'll be right back.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Lagos, Nigeria, and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, October 19th. Is the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations in trouble? Well, it seems so. Morocco has asked African soccer's governing body, CAF, to postpone the tournament because of the Ebola outbreak. CAF has rejected the call and even written to some countries to be on standby to host. But indications so far are that no country is willing to host the tournament due to start on January 17th and run through February 8th. So, what is the situation right now? Nothing definitive will be known about the tournament until early next month, when CAF President Issa Hayatou is due to meet the Moroccan authorities to discuss their request for postponement. For now, Morocco has played down its request for the tournament to be deferred to a later date. Morocco's sports minister has now claimed his country does not want to jeopardize the tournament, but would like to discuss the potential health implications with CAF. There is no way we are talking about the cancellation of the tournament, Mohamed Ouzine says. We are talking with CAF to find a solution. This past week, CAF asked seven countries whether they will be able to step in at the last minute to host the 16-nation three-week tournament should Morocco withdraw. South Africa gave a lukewarm response. There are just too many factors to consider for South Africa if we are to host a tournament of this magnitude, Sports Minister Fikile Mbalula says in a statement. Our major concern is the cost implication of such a tournament when South Africa is currently grappling with its own fiscal challenges, he says. Ebola is also a major concern to the South African authorities, who say the tournament may also pose a challenge on how they grapple with the outbreak. Ghana's Sports Minister Mahama Yariga has also confirmed CAF's letter, asking his country to consider hosting the tournament. But Ghana has not said whether or not it will be willing to host Africa's football extravaganza next year. The country is bidding for the 2017 edition. However, the umbrella Ghana Medical Association, GMA, has kicked against the country hosting the 2015 tournament. GMA official Justice Yangsin warns that it will be risky to accept CAF's request because of the dangers of Ebola on the population. He says all stakeholders need to look at the CAF request properly before a decision is taken. Nearly 4,500 people have died from the worst Ebola outbreak on record, with the epicenter of the outbreak located in the three West African countries of Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. At least five West African nations, Ghana, Mali, Togo, Burkina Faso, and Senegal, are in the top running to pick the tickets to the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations, which may explain Morocco's fears about the spread of the virus to its territory during the tournament. Talking of Ebola fears, African players in Europe are feeling the backlash from the outbreak of the virus. A Sierra Leone player has been asked to stay away from his club in Greece after competing in African Nations Cup qualifiers. John Camara has been told by Greek second division club Lamia to stay away for the next 3 weeks after he returned from playing for Sierra Leone against Cameroon. During the Nations Cup qualifiers, Sierra Leone's footballers were confined to their hotel in Cameroon and had their temperatures checked twice daily. And a French club has ordered a player to have medical tests on his return from Africa. Ivory Coast fullback Siaka Thiel, who played in two matches against the Democratic Republic of Congo over the last week, was asked to undergo a medical examination on his return to his French club Montpellier on Friday. It was reported last week that Guinea international Las Bangoura was asked by his club not to play in his country's Nations Cup qualifiers against Ghana. But it turned out that the Spanish-based player had not even been called up for the matches.
Hi, this is VOA's Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. I'm in Lagos, and you're listening to my friend Segun Dot on the Spot Adeyemi and Nightline Africa Sports.
Thank you, Sonny. I'm glad you are having a great visit to Nigeria. What with the prodigious reception for you by Brilla FM, Africa's number one sports radio station, right here in Lagos on Friday. Keep enjoying your stay, my friend. Away from the Ebola crisis and football now, the stage is set for the knockout semi-final stage of the ongoing 2014 African Women Championship in Namibia, with the conclusion of the group matches on Saturday in the double-header semi-final slated for Wednesday at the Sam Nujoma Stadium in the Namibian capital, Windhoek. South Africa will take on perennial champion Nigeria, while Cameroon and Ivory Coast will slog it out. South Africa squeezed into the semi-final stage after beating Algeria 5-1 in their last Group B game on Saturday. The South Africans finished the group on 4 points, 2 behind leader Cameroon, though the Cameroonians lost 1-0 to Ghana in their final Group B game, also on Saturday. That did not prevent them from finishing top of the group and advancing to the knockout stage. For its part, Nigeria knocked out host Namibia with a 2-0 win on Friday in their final Group A match. The Nigerians finished the group stage on a clean slate, amassing the maximum 9 points. Ivory Coast and Zambia played 1-1 in the other final Group A match on Friday, but the Ivorians still joined Nigeria in the semi-finals. The third place match and the final are slated for October 25th. The African Women's Championship is also a qualifying tournament for the FIFA Women's World Cup. The top three finishers at the ongoing edition of the African Championship will represent the continent at the 2015 FIFA Women's World Cup in Canada. In athletics, the Association of International Marathons and Distance Races, AIMS, has announced that Kenyan Dennis Kimeto, who broke the world marathon record in Berlin, Germany last month, will be the sole candidate for this year's AIMS Male Best Marathon Runners Award. In the women's class, AIMS said two candidates, Rita Jeptu and Florence Kiplagat, both from Kenya, will contest the award. A gala featuring the 2014 AIMS Best Marathon Runner Awards and other honors will take place on November 7th, 2 days before the Athens Marathon. Finally, there is yet more honor for Kimeto. The Kenyan is among the two Africans who are in the running for the 2014 World Athletes of the Year Award. The other is Genzebe Dibaba of Ethiopia. On Friday, World Athletics Governing Body, IAAF, named Kimeto among the three candidates who were shortlisted for the men's award. The 30-year-old Kimeto is the world record holder at the marathon and the 25-kilometer road distance. Kimeto will compete against Mutaz Essa Bashim from Qatar and Renaud Levin from France. On her part, Dibaba will compete for the women's award with Valerie Adams from New Zealand and Daphne Schippers from the Netherlands. Dibaba, who is 23, is the reigning 2014 World Indoor Champion and World Indoor Record Holder in the 3,000 meters. The IAAF said the finalists were selected after a two-week-long poll of the World Athletics family. The Council of the International Athletics Foundation will select the male and female winners during the 2014 World Athletics Gala in Monaco on November 21st. Jamaica's Usain Bolt and Shelly-Ann Fraser-Pryce are the reigning World Athletes of the Year. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Thanks, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. Hook up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline African Sports. Well, you know, it's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
I get this friend where we get from Calabar, Labaken, Friday. Come to think she be my personal person. But anytime when she come around, she get this feeling where they do me like fever. And when she dance with my messy boo, he they be me like saying for fana. Me like how she play the baseline. It makes me sing ooh la la la. The way she the way she that. It makes me sing ooh la la la. Oh yeah. When mommy come back, she a drop. Daddy come to me a cross. And when they ask me, it was me. That's what me talk say. I don't like this shirt, touching body. But you know say, my mama don't like them. I don't want this shirt, touching body. But you know say, my papa don't like them. It's a lot of fun. Oh, na, 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 na. Na 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 na
Somebody, go chop somebody, go chop somebody, go
Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The people of Mozambique and the political leaders should be commended for making sufficient progress towards a stable transition to a more perfect democratic dispensation. This does not mean that there have been no setbacks along the way. since Mozambique achieved its independence from Portugal in 1975. The most recent setback was the decision of the 66-year-old rebel leader turned opposition leader, Alfonso Daclama, to go into hiding in his former hideout during the Civil War for 2 years. He only came hiding very recently to contest the presidential election. Nevertheless, since the Rome Treaty that ended the Civil War in 1992 and followed with the first recognized democratic elections in 1994, there have been two previous change of administration in the country. Now, despite allegations of fraud and dirty tricks, it is more than likely that there will be another peaceful change when the final results of the presidential and parliamentary elections are announced by the National Electoral Commission. The elections held last Wednesday was peaceful and fair, according to all the national and international observers. The fighting that broke out last week occurred in the rebel stronghold during the counting period, that is in Nampula, with 2 million voters out of the 10.7 registered voters, Tete province, and Baia. This may explain why Richard Daclama is so unhappy when early projection showed the ruling party presidential candidate, Mr. Felipe Joaquin Nyusi, 55-year-old engineer and former defense minister. It was projected that the Frelimo candidate would receive about 60% of the vote, with 30% for Mr. Daclama. That is understandable, since Mr. Daclama was not present for most of the campaign and only came out of hiding just before the election. Previously, other Frelimo candidates had won with a landslide. It is also understandable why Mr. Daclama should be unhappy. He had lost on many occasions to Frelimo candidates. One, Mr. Joaquim Chissano, defeated him in 1994, and he has lost twice to the present incumbent, President Armando Tibusta. There is projection that the parliamentary election may be close and more balanced, and a new party, the Mozambique Democratic Movement and RENAMO, are projected to gain seats in the new parliament, and that Frelimo will be losing seats in the parliament. This too is not surprising, although Mozambique today is one of Africa's fastest growing economy, the wealth has not trickled down to the ordinary man and woman in the streets, and they are not satisfied with the progress of the country. Mozambique is blessed with enormous wealth and natural resources. It has a large offshore natural gas project, and it is hoped that this would increase the wealth of the country. But this needs to go down to the people, and this will be the test for the new government. The question now is, what will RENAMO do when the final results are announced? It is necessary to bear in mind that after every elections in which Mr. Daclama had participated, he had denounced the results. Yet ways and means have been found to encourage him to participate in the political process. It is possible that this will also happen this time. He should have some hope, since he would gain some seats in the new parliament along with the new political party, and the government seats will be reduced. So this will have enormous possibility for negotiations. And Mr. Gatlama has proven that he has very good negotiating skills. It is also important to note that since Mr. Gatlama changed from a rebel leader to a political leader, he has shown some ability to work within a political system. Mr. Gatlama once told this commentator during the Rome meeting that signed the peace treaty that he is no longer a bomb thrower and he will not be a Savimbi. Of course, he was referring to the highly controversial rebel leader of UNITA in Angola, Savimbi, who died years ago. I thank you.
Thank you very much. And that was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, sports editor Segun Ademi, and our engineer for today, Jackson Witt. We say thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Sanctions have emerged as a leading tool of American foreign policy. The goal, said U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Counter-Threat Finance and Sanctions, Peter Harrell, is to maximize the impact of sanctions while minimizing their costs on innocent civilians and private businesses at home and abroad. Recently, the sanctions tool has been wielded against the growing terrorist threat known as ISIL, or the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. Unlike al-Qaeda, which largely relied on deep-pocketed donors for financing, ISIL derives much of its funding internally from criminal activities. In other words, it raises much of its money through extortion, looting towns and villages, and selling oil in territory under its control. But ISIL also makes use of external sources of funding through oil smuggling to neighboring countries, kidnapping for ransom, and other sources. Countering ISIL's financing is absolutely central to the United States' objective of destroying ISIL and ensuring that it cannot attack the U.S. or its allies. It is part of a broader strategy that also includes conducting a military campaign in Iraq and Syria, preventing foreign fighters from traveling to the region, delegitimizing ISIL's ideology, and providing humanitarian relief to the people of Iraq and Syria. The United States will be working with states bordering Iraq and Syria to prevent ISIL from smuggling oil outside of territory it inhabits or from bringing cash into those places. The U.S. will be using designation authorities to sanction people and companies doing business with ISIL or giving it money. Already, an impressive array of countries is joining the effort. The U.S. is working with partners to build an international coalition that shares information and develops joint approaches to combating ISIL's financing. Private companies will have as important a role to play as governments around the world in cutting off funding to ISIL. The private sector needs to help identify and cut off potential avenues for ISIL's illicit financial flows. Sanctions have a clear and critical role to play in the effort to defeat terrorist threats like ISIL.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.